Hey, everybody. It's the Weekend Interview Show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and we have a couple of really good guests today. First up will be Tom Barry. Then in the second hour at 4 o'clock, we'll be talking to former Congressman Bob Barr from Georgia. So stay tuned for that. Producer's getting Tom Barry on the phone here real quick. And before we get started with that, I want to say thanks to the guys over at antiwar.com. Brandon Snyder blogged me today, and I want to thank you for the link love there. And I got to say about antiwar.com that if I was pro-war, I would still go to that site all the time just so I could look at all the death and destruction that I had helped cause, and I could be very, very proud. So anyway, that's my recommendation for antiwar.com. And now do we have the guest on the line?
Hello.
All right. Tom Barry is the co-founder and policy director of the Interhemispheric Resource Center. He's the author of almost 30 books on American foreign policy, and he wrote the recent article, Is Iran Next or In These Times? Welcome to the show, sir.
Hi, Scott.
The article that you wrote for In These Times begins with sort of a rehashing of how Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, and the Office of Special Plans at the Pentagon took over intelligence gathering and war planning from the CIA and the State Department. So I suppose before we really get into Iran, we ought to go ahead and give you an opportunity to sort of rehearse the history of how these guys got us into the war in Iraq first.
Fine. Well, as a little background to that, the neoconservatives have long criticized the State Department and the CIA as having moderate threat assessments. This goes back to the mid-1970s, and they have long sought independent intelligence gathering, and the famous Team B in the 1970s that criticized both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party for its detente policies with Russia, and they put forward a more alarmist scenario with the Soviet Union. So it's been in their agenda for three decades to take control of intelligence out of what they can see the moderates, progressives, and liberals in the State Department and the CIA. And as after September 11th, the neoconservatives were able to do this by establishing their own office in the Pentagon to establish the rationale for invading Iraq.
Okay, and now it turns out that this guy, Ahmed Chalabi, that the neoconservatives were working with and apparently had planned to put him in as the new puppet of Iraq, it turns out that he was working for Iran, and he was funneling information into the Office of Special Plans, which worked at least indirectly, perhaps directly, for the Likud Party in Israel. And so it's kind of interesting to me. It makes sense to me that Iran would want to see Saddam Hussein go, but the same neoconservatives who Iran was helping with the bad Iraq intel through Chalabi, apparently at the same time they had a covert operation in the works to overthrow the regime of Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran. Is that right?
It's not as conspiratorial as all that. We have to remember that that Bush himself, our president, identified Iran as one of the three countries in the axis of evil, and in his State of the Union address said that we will no longer tolerate this evil and set Iran up for as one of the next targets for preemptive war. So it wasn't just something that it was planned in the recesses of the Pentagon. The president adopted this, both the neocon ideology and agenda, after September 11th.
Okay, hang tight right there. We'll be right back and pick this up when we get back from the break. It's the Weekend Interview Show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and the guest is Tom Barry. He's the co-founder and policy director of the Interhemispheric Resource Center. Now, before we went to break, sir, the strange part that I was referring to was just that Iran would be helping these neocons come up with the lies to justify invading Iraq when they're next on the chopping block.
I, I don't think that that's well established. It's established that Chalabi had been in contact with Iran, but all along the neocons have had backdoor channels with Iran. Again, going back to the 1980s, where there was the Iran Contra scandal, where that Iran was not a friend of the United States, but at the same time we were through backdoor channels selling Iran arms for other
Israel, right?
Through Israel, that's right, through for other purposes to help the Contras and Nicaragua. So that what they're doing is keeping the eye on the ball. And the first one, and the first target was Iraq, and now with Iraq occupied, that there is a possibility that they'll be looking for other targets, and Iran is a possible next target, and that's particularly possible given that as we remember in Iraq, there's the majority of the population is Shiite, which is the same as in Iran. So that if there is indeed democracy in Iraq, it could be a Shiite a controlled country, which would be very close to Iran. And with Iran having missiles, long distance missiles, and the possibility of developing nuclear power. Nuclear weapons that both the United States and Israel may be looking to preemptively strike against that capacity before they lose control of the – pardon me?
How sophisticated is that capacity? There seems to be some dispute as to whether the Iranians are really working on a bomb or not.
That's right, and that it's commonly accepted, except for the neocons, and that Iran does not have nuclear weapons. There is some question of whether it's developing nuclear weapons, and if it is, most experts who say that it wouldn't have the capacity until around 2006, if indeed it's starting to develop now.
And in their current negotiations with the United Nations and with, I guess it was France, Germany, and Great Britain, did they not come to some sort of arrangement where they agreed to internationalize all of their nuclear projects and to let the IAEA come in and inspect any place they wanted whenever they wanted?
That's right. That Iran had been pursuing a nuclear uranium enrichment program without the oversight of the International Atomic Energy Association, and it agreed once that was discovered to let those inspectors in. The United States would like to push that now into the UN Security Council to impose sanctions. The United States already has sanctions against Iran, but it would like to make those international sanctions that other countries would join in as well. There are other scenarios that the way that this could play out, that there could be a framework agreement where the industrial countries, the powers of the UN, so the Security Council, would agree to a uranium enrichment program, or even indeed supply nuclear fuel for peaceful purposes if Iran would agree to desist from developing nuclear weapons.
Besides the neoconservatives, is the general foreign policy consensus in D.C. that we need to just work cooperatively with Iran and try to come to a diplomatic solution to this? I sort of get the idea that it's John Bolton in the State Department is sort of leading this whole thing, and his boss, Colin Powell, doesn't seem to have much say in it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, outside of the neoconservatives, there certainly would be widespread support for diplomatic solutions, and even among militarists who would like to reform, have regime change in Iran, there's the realities that the United States does not have either the superior power that it once boasted, or just the troops on the ground to enable that to happen.
Well, and just for the record, at this point, the IAEA says that Iran has a clean bill of health, and there's
That's
really
right.
no reason to. It's interesting to me. It sort of seems like the setup here, especially going through the Security Council to get a new resolution and sanctions there, and we have the inspections, the UN inspections going on. It seems like they're setting up Iran to be in the same position as Iraq, where they say, well, we know they're hiding something, and they're not proving their negative well enough. And is this just all a setup where we can have it next year?
The parallels are striking, and you mentioned several of them. There are others. The congressional resolutions that have been passed in the last couple of years, and they have been pushed through by institutes like the Coalition for Democracy in Iran, which is a neoconservative front group, the American Enterprise Institute, and the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee of resolutions that are supported by bipartisan majorities that repeatedly condemn Iran either for violations of human rights, for intending to develop nuclear weapons, several resolutions. That's very similar to what happened in the 1990s, late 1990s, when resolutions were passed again at the inspiration of the neocons to establish a bipartisan foundation for support of expatriate groups and eventual regime change and invasion of Iraq.
Well, the neocons must have a lot of allies inside the Democratic Party because Bill Clinton signed that one, and he got the Democrats to vote for this most recent one against Iran, right?
And President Clinton did not support that resolution. He resisted it, but the Iraq Liberation Act. The pressure was so great, and he caved into that pressure. The way these resolutions are worded, that you or I could support them for the most part. We're supporting human rights, we're supporting democratic change, in Iran and so on, but, it's because Iran is targeted. It's set it up so the people who hadn't congressional members who haven't really considered Iran, don't know the Middle East well, get them on board, and then when push comes to shove, they'll have had a record of being in this coalition and more likely to go forward to the next step.
Right, sort of like throwing your hat over the fence so that you have to climb over it.
Right.
Okay. And
another similarity that's striking is the way the neoconservatives have expressed interest in the rights of women in Iran, and the same kind of new concerns about the repression of women in Islamic societies.
Is that just because they're out of other excuses?
Yes, and so that happened preceding Iraq, and they're making a big deal of that now of what of women's rights in Iran as something that we need to be concerned about and move politically and militarily to support a reform that can benefit women in Iran, and that's another way that they can bring in progressives and liberals into their cause.
Well, and it's interesting too that they tend to. I've read actually things by, say, for example, Michael Ledeen talking about how everyone in Iran is so young and they're so fed up with the mullahs that if we were to invade, that they would all join our side.
Yeah,
and
just like
of course,
the cakewalk
I'm sure probably greet us with flowers and candy, right?
Right. Well, that's that's similar as well. They believe that you cannot constructively engage with societies like Iran. That by giving any credence to reformists in Iran, people who work through the system, the parliament, even the student groups that protest peacefully, that if you work with those groups, you give credence to Iran. What we need to do is work with reformers, quote, moderate reformers who are outside of that system, and if we empower those groups, the scenario that you described will follow, that Ledeen has described as well, that it will be the regime will collapse.
And by moderate groups, he's referring to the Mujahideen al-Khalq? Or?
That's right. And
they're pretty moderate, those guys, is that right?
They're moderate. Yeah, no, it's just they're just selling it. I mean, and they don't name these groups publicly, but in terms of when they're talking about it and building support among congressional groups, but the people they're close to, another one is the son of the former Shah of Iran, and they believe that that's a possibility for regime change. Installing.
Are you kidding me?
No.
Are you talking? Wait. You're saying that the neoconservatives want to overthrow the Ayatollahs and replace them with the son of the Shah?
Yes, as part of, and they would frame it, and they do frame it as part of a democratic transition. You won't have democracy immediately, but you have a respected figure, namely the son of the former Shah, to establish the stability that will set up the possibility of a democratic transition.
Great. All right, we'll be right back. It's the Weekend Interview Show. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and the guest is Tom Berry. He's the co-founder and policy director of the Interhemispheric Resource Center, and he's written 30-something books, I think, on foreign policy. Wow, so before the break there, we're talking about how the neoconservatives would like to overthrow the mullahs in Iran and replace them with a combination or one or the other of either the Mujahideen al-Khalik, a communist terrorist group, or with the son of the Shah. And that reminded me of an old saying by, I think it was Santayana, that said, those who refuse to learn from history are condemned to repeat it.
Well, ironically, the neoconservatives are close followers of history. That they believe, but they base their history on basically World War II, that we can defeat evil and that we should have defeated evil before Hitler grew so strong. That's their main history lesson, and what they are looking at, rather than looking at the details of Iran, what they're looking at is a much wider agenda in the Middle East. They see that evil is lurking throughout the Middle East, and as Michael Ledeen said, who's the founder of this Coalition for Democracy in Iran and a colleague, a friend of the son of the former Shah, now deceased, that stability gives me the heebie-jeebies. What they're looking for is creative destruction in the Middle East.
That's exactly what Ledeen calls it, isn't it?
Yes.
That's his phrase.
Yes, and so that... They're not looking. So their immediate plans may seem crazy, but they are looking for change in the long term, a decade or so. That what we want to do is with our regime change plans, occupation, use of superior military force by both the United States and Israel, that we will strike down these governments that threaten Israel and that do not represent the true allies of the United States, and that we will see and we can help shape a new Middle East, a restructured Middle East.
And so where do you disagree with them?
In
general, I don't mean like every little point. Obviously, there's probably a million. But, I mean, generally speaking, you think that that's counterproductive?
Yes, it's counterproductive. It's delusional the methods that they are employing will be counterproductive and that will create more terrorists, that will align more people with the fundamentalists and the militant Islamists. Heller, I would agree, and that's where they can bring in liberals, progressives, and so forth, that there needs to be a change in the Middle East. And so how to go about that is a discussion that we do need to to have. Diplomacy is one of the ways to do it, and we're, in terms of focusing on Iran, that there is a strong democratic current in Iran that eventually will gain force. But in the last year or two, that these democratic reformists have suffered losses because of U.S. Policies and Israeli policies in the Middle East that have made it harder for the reformists to argue that we need to be talking with the United States.
Okay, so when we intervene on the side of, well, I guess our little L liberal forces in Iran, we actually discredit them and make it harder for them to...
That's certainly true. That it creates creates backlash sentiment and nationalist sentiment that is directed against the United States and Israel, and that's not productive in moving a democratic transformation forward in Iran or elsewhere in the Middle East.
And you know, something that really I think is a major part of the debate here that or should be. Is the population of Iran and how literally a supermajority, like right at 63% of the people in Iran are under the age of 30. And that means that either they can be a brand new force in politics in Iran, or it means they can be a nationalist army defending themselves from us.
Right.
And it seems like that's a lot of people of fighting age.
Right. The irony of the argument that both the president uses and the neocons is that what we're seeing is a fear of the United States, a fear of our values, however we are not willing to engage these countries to have the exchange that would show the values of the United States and Western countries. That instead we impose sanctions, cut off all relations, and you know we see that a similar case with Cuba. That we are indeed afraid of constructive engagement with countries. That what we should be doing is opening exchanges and encouraging foreign investment, encouraging trade and personal relations with these countries that will influence the students and move them in the direction of democratic reformism, where they already are at. However, the hardliners have in both the United States and Israel are reshaping the Middle East and the current so that people are supporting Osama bin Laden as the only way to fight back against this the superior power.
And we've made him a hero.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
All right, everybody, it's the weekend interview show. Tom Barry's our guest. He's from the Interhemispheric Resource Center. And he wrote a great article for In These Times called Is Iran Next? And when we went to the break there, sir, you were talking about how our government's reckless policy in the Middle East has actually turned the population of that part of the world toward Osama bin Laden, not away from him.
That's right. They see him as someone who is striking back at the empire and that we need to be concerned about that. We certainly show no by looking now at and making these moves against Iran in terms of the congressional resolutions and the rhetoric of the president and the neoconservatives. That it's very possible that we will be influencing these young people that you're talking about in Iran, who are making up their minds of what kind of country they want to see and what kind of Middle East they want to see.
Well, it was in the news last week that we sold 500 Bunker Buster bombs to the Israelis. How did that news play in the Arab world?
I can't say. It just would reaffirm all of these moves reaffirm that the United States and Israel have a dual agenda. The United States is not an independent actor in the Middle East, that it's allied very closely with the hardliners of the Likud party in Israel, and it points out the hypocrisy of the United States, and although it only seems to be outside of the United States where that hypocrisy is detected, where that we can develop these new flexible nuclear weapons and sell them to a country that is a nuclear power, but it's not an acknowledged one. We're so concerned about another Middle Eastern country developing nuclear weapons, but it goes unacknowledged that Israel already has a nuclear capacity, a nuclear weapons capacity, and is not a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. That we would win respect in the Middle East if we pointed out that Israel should also come into compliance with the provisions of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
It's interesting that we're going around enforcing world law against the quote-unquote rogue states and forcing them into the international community, or at least to obey the will of the international community, in Colin Powell's words, and yet we're sort of the last rogue state, aren't we, as we go around forcing everyone into the international community. Eventually all this world law is going to have to apply to us too, isn't it?
Yes, there was an interesting comment by Paul Krugman yesterday that I thought was very observing, soon the United States, the only allies that the United States will have left will be non-democratic countries, so that this grand coalition that President Bush has talked about for this restructuring of the Middle East is not there, and that the only countries that express sympathy for our policies are non-democratic ones, in terms of Russia, in terms of its policies, how it deals with terrorism, China, in terms of its policies, how it deals with its Islamic minority, that these are becoming our only allies, and that certainly will be true if there's a second Bush administration.
Ron Paul once said that by the time we have no sovereignty left, we'll have no friends left.
That's sovereignty is a very difficult issue, and to deal with, the United States supports national sovereignty, but for other, it believes in the concept of national sovereignty, but it doesn't apply it to itself. It believes that it can violate other countries' national sovereignty, but it stands above international law, whether it be in international criminal matters or global climate change, arms treaties, whatever.
Now, see, I would tend to argue that actually the American Constitution is superior to any world law. I would just not exercise our sovereignty in violation of others' sovereignty in the way that our government is doing now. But there does need to be consistency there. Either there's world law or there's not. I would prefer not. But if there's going to be, it's pretty strange when the enforcer of that world law is immune from it.
I would agree with you that the United States certainly needs to withhold the right to defend itself. It doesn't need to go to an international body of the United Nations whenever it's threatened, but that's not the case, no one is asking the United States to give up that right.
Right. Now, did you read the article in the September 27th Newsweek called Wargaming the Mullahs?
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, what it said in there was that the military has been running a lot of war games on what it would be like to invade Iran. And what they found was, quote, there is no way to keep it from escalating. And the military, the brass, apparently the professionals in the military, were, quote, horrified by basically the policy that Douglas Feith and the boys in the Pentagon – are pushing a repeat of the plan for the invasion of Iraq. And the military is saying, no, we can't. Don't do it. And yet, apparently, the neocons are going on ahead at full steam.
Well, hopefully not full speed, but that the presidential directive that they have been shaping in the last couple of years has not been finalized. But it's very possible if there is a second administration that it would go full speed ahead. I don't foresee the possibility of an invasion. I think that it will be preemptive strikes against the missile facilities and the nuclear facilities in Iran.
And see, and that's where the escalation comes in, because if we do that, they're going to start shooting whatever they have, nukes or not, at Israel. And if Israel gets involved, I mean, there's a big chain of dominoes in Central Asia there that could fall. I mean, if Musharraf is couped in Pakistan and the Islamic bomb in Pakistan is unleashed, then you have India jumping in. China's not going to let India win clear cut over Pakistan.
Yes. You know,
I mean, this could be a disaster.
It would be, yes, it certainly would be a disaster. And that Iran has said, the foreign minister, that if Israel and the United States have the right of preemptive strikes, that if the rhetoric escalates against Iran, that we too will assume that right of preemptive strikes. So that it's very possible that we would be driving Iran into adopting the kind of national security doctrine that is now the official doctrine of the United States of preemptive strikes.
Reminds me of that George Carlin bit where he says, we just couldn't wait for that Cold War to be over so we can go play with our toys in the sand.
Yeah.
We have to go play with our toys in the sand. We're going to end up getting, you know, we already have gotten tens of thousands of people, and we could get millions of people killed so that we can go play with our toys.
Well, it's not just a boy thing to play with toys. That there's a lot of money involved as well, so that that we can't forget. Ideology, I think, is driving this, but that you find that many of the ideologues, like Doug Feist, have close connections with the military-industrial complex, have benefited personally through business deals representing missile defense manufacturers, arms manufacturers, both in Israel and the United States. So that ideology and personal financial benefit often come together.
Yeah, actually, I just learned that in reading your article, that at the time that Feith and David Woomser wrote A Clean Break for Benjamin Netanyahu, that he was actually a lawyer representing military hardware firms in Israel at the time.
That's right. Two-thirds of his law firm, which was based both in Jerusalem and in the United States, represented Israeli arms manufacturers that had deals with U.S. arms manufacturers.
Mr. Barry, I kind of feel guilty because I know there's some people driving around who are saying, who the hell is Doug Feith? What are these guys talking about? And, you know, to most people, the administration means Bush, Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld, you know, the
right.
Tiny little handful, Colin Powell, maybe. So who are these third and fourth level people in the Pentagon that nobody's ever heard of, and why is it that we should be so concerned with them instead of Rumsfeld and Cheney, for example?
Well, the way I describe it, Scott, there's a small circle of neoconservative ideologues, polemicists, and they would include Doug Feith, who's the third most powerful person in the Pentagon, the director of the Office of Planning, Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of Defense, people like John Bolton, you mentioned, and the State Department, a small circle of people who have an ideology that they've been forming over the last two or three decades. And then you have the higher levels, the president himself, Rumsfeld and Cheney, better known figures who have adopted the agenda, the vision of the neoconservatives. They are not neoconservatives themselves, but the simplistic view of the world, the good versus evil, the powerful forces of the United States, the chosen people, the mission of the United States, that the kind of all forms part of the neoconservative agenda, is an easy one to adopt and to explain U.S. foreign policy to the public. But the people
or to the president.
Pardon me?
Or to the president.
Yes. And so it's a very it's a very simplistic agenda, but it's a very
leaves Colin Powell basically as the last of just the plain Rockefeller Republicans trying to hold the rest of these guys back. Am I right?
Yeah, to the degree that he's trying to hold them back. I mean, I think that we all have wished that he had more integrity. That we haven't seen that. He's played more of the good soldier role. All along, that he has, while making countervailing statements at some point, he has not had the integrity to stand up to the president and do what he should have done, is resign.
Yeah, I'm with you there. That speech in front of the UN, I think it'll be on his tombstone. I hope so. It sure is on the tombstone of 50,000 other people, so. Screw him. Anyway,
yeah, well, he's trying to, you know, not showing up at the Republican convention. He's trying to reshape his legacy a bit at the end. But
well, in case his son at the FCC is listening, tell your dad I said too little, too late, pal. Anyway, okay, now we're almost out of time here. We got about, say, 3.5-4 minutes before the next break, and then we're going to have to wrap up. So
okay.
I want to spend the rest of the time now on really the most important part of this in terms of actual accountability is there's a criminal investigation going on about passing secrets to Israel, a guy named Larry Franklin, a minor neocon, I suppose.
Right.
And I understand from reading your article that this investigation actually is far further, wider, and deeper than just Larry Franklin passing some papers through AIPAC. Am I right?
That's right. There, that's what alerted the public's attention to the matter, that there's this criminal investigation where the FBI had been following Larry Franklin, who was drawn into this office of Douglas Feith early on after September 11th to help shape this policy directive regarding Iran. He had once worked in Israel and is an expert in some degree an expert in Iran. So that it was learned that there was a 2-year-old investigation of Franklin, but other news reports earlier on have been tracking these back channel deal meetings with Ladeen, Franklin, Harold Rode, another person who worked in official who is shaping policy in the Middle East with Doug Feith's meeting in Europe, Paris, Rome, with arms dealers who they had been involved with, Iranian arms dealers they had been involved with back in the 80s, the Iran-Contra affair, intelligence officials in Italy, Israeli officials, that investigation is will be pursued by the Senate Intelligence Committee, but is being postponed until after the election. Also, that there is an inquiry at the House Judiciary Committee into these same series of meetings. It could be very explosive, and hopefully it will illustrate the degree that these kind of back channel negotiations, agreements are driving U.S. foreign policy, just as they did in Central America regarding Nicaragua.
It interesting, the exact same characters, Ladeen, Rode, Gorbanifar, Israel, it's the
Iran.
Same cast, isn't it? Iran, yes.
unfortunately, one of the things that was striking to me is when when the Bush administration came to power, that no one remembered who these folks were, that the neoconservatives was a term that many of us were familiar with in the 1980s, because these figures were had become involved in the scandal and had helped shape the foreign policy of the Reagan administration. But the historical memory in the United States is so short. These people are not going to go away, unfortunately. They came under investigation in the 80s and also in the 70s for the same kind of dealings. They're true believers. They're going to be around whether the Bush administration is reelected or not, and help shaping, however they can to shape U.S. foreign policy.
And so that we never forget again, you guys at the Interhemispheric Resource Center have a project called Right Web. Isn't that you guys?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I'm sorry. We're going to break here, and we'll be right back and talk about where people can read what you write and your resource center. It's the Weekend Interview Show on Republic Broadcasting Network. Wrapping up our interview with Tom Barry on the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. Tom Barry is the co-founder and policy director of the Interhemispheric Resource Center and is the author of almost 30 books on American foreign policy. Now, I want to give you a chance to tell us all about your research group and what kind of things you do, where people can read what you write, and about Right Web and all those great things. But first, I want to ask you a question. When I read about foreign policy experts having their roundtable meetings, there's always a realist and a Wilsonian and a neoconservative and, I don't know, six or seven different brands of interventionists. And apparently nobody who believes in non-intervention is ever allowed to sit at the table and discuss foreign policy. And so I want to ask you, how far away are we from a point where a libertarian like myself can sit at the table and say, no, all of you are wrong. What we need to do is just completely ignore Iran and let them do whatever they want because it's none of our business.
I think we're very far away from that point. The foreign policy community, as you pointed out, it comes from a liberal establishment that is Wilsonian, and that kind of internationalism has now been transformed into kind of a right-wing interventionism driven by neoconservatives, libertarians, isolationists, isolation, whether progressive or from the right, have no part of that discussion of shaping U.S. foreign policy agenda.
Max Boot at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Pardon me, I'm sorry, yes. Max Boot, you said?
Yeah, Max Boot at the Council on Foreign Relations wrote that the neoconservatism is just hard Wilsonianism. They're Wilsonians. They just really mean it, and they'll kill you.
That's right. And that's I'm not a big fan of the paleo conservatives like Pat Buchanan, but you look at their analysis, and they will be criticizing what we call the neoconservatives as just liberals and the old liberals of the Washington. Wall Street, New York, liberals who have an internationalist agenda that are taking us away from our national interests. I agree with that to a certain extent.
Very interesting. All right, so now you got about 2 minutes to tell us about Right Web and the Interhemispheric Resource Center, books you've written, articles that people could read.
Fine, Scott. The project that I'll talk about, we have three projects. One on foreign policy. I founded Foreign Policy in Focus, which is foreign policy think tank that is a joint project with the Institute for Policy Studies. But I now direct a project called Right Web that looks at the organizations and the individuals that we describe as the architecture of power, the right-wing architecture of power in the United States that has yanked the the agenda, both foreign policy and domestic agenda, to the right over the last 30 years, and as a way of trying to explain how this has happened and who these figures are, right web profiles of the main individuals and organizations.
Okay, and what's your website there?
It's irc-online.org, and through there you can find Right Web, or just do a search for Right Web. And if you don't know who Doug Fife is, we have a good profile of him and Ladeen and so on as background information.
Great. Hey, thank you very much, everybody. Tom Barry is the co-founder and policy director of the Interhemispheric Resource Center. Thank you very much for coming on the show today, sir. All right, we'll be right back with Bob Barr.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.